Hello and welcome to Political Heat, the podcast that aims to make sense of climate politics. I'm your host, Amy Mount. Previous episodes have mostly been concerned with domestic politics, and let's face it, that's what tends to occupy the minds of most politicians. Our Prime Minister recently brought one of his predecessors out of political retirement to become Foreign Secretary so that Sunak can focus more on matters closer to home. Yet, we're in a time of heightened awareness of the world beyond our borders. A global pandemic, wars and migration are major reasons for that. Sometimes so too are climate impacts, like when wildfires rage towards Greek holiday resorts. And while there's a great deal we can do to tackle climate change right here in the UK, this must be part of a global effort. We need other countries to do their bit. So in this episode, I want to look at international climate diplomacy. What is it and how can it make a difference? I'm joined by Camilla Bourne, who has accumulated a huge amount of experience in this field since we first met as youth climate campaigners. She held the pen on the strategy for COP26, the UN climate talks that the UK hosted in 2021, and she then went on to be right-hand woman to the COP president, Alok Sharma, as his advisor. Camilla now works with a range of international institutions, governments, businesses, and philanthropies to make their climate strategy more impactful. Camilla, great to have you here on Political Heat.
Thanks for having me, Amy. It's great to be here.
So your career has taken you right to the heart of the global negotiations on climate. How did you end up there?
That's a very good question. I guess, you know, if I think back a decade ago, we didn't have an international agreement on climate change. And we didn't necessarily have the compass of where we wanted to go. Some countries had come up with their own plans, but not every country in the world had. And we all know that we can't deal with climate change or climate risk on our own, and therefore we have to get everyone together. Also, at the time, that was where the exciting people were. That was where you could meet people from all across the world with amazing ideas about what the future would look like. And I was really drawn to that energy. And, you know, as you said, starting as youth climate campaigners, there was so much dynamism and excitement about what the world could look like and how we could make a really truly impactful global agreement that could be fair and could move us forward in the fight against climate change.
So you kind of did that campaigning like as an activist, as a volunteer, and then segued into making that your career.
Yeah, and I did take a big step back. I remember when I first was moving from working on kind of grassroots youth climate campaigning into the more kind of elite, murky world of international climate. And I did spend quite a lot of time thinking about, am I the right person to do that? And I decided that, yes, it was an elite, murky world in some ways, but elite isn't necessarily a bad thing. Elite is about taking more responsibility. And I felt I had the capacity to be able to do that. And I wanted to engage in a way that was really going to have impact and be able to make change. And doing that in a context of really valuing the grassroots work too, because the truth of the matter is when it comes to a global agreement, it's not like a bunch of people in a room spending 2 weeks working out what that global agreement is. It is the amalgamation of all the politics of every single country in the world coming together and saying, how are we going to restructure our economies? And that's a huge change. And it goes right from the local level, right up to the global and back down again. And that's the true reality of UN climate talks.
And so having made that journey from activism into, as you say, that elite world of international diplomacy, how did it feel when you find yourself sitting right next to the COP president and negotiating and working with people from across the world in a diplomatic capacity?
I mean, it's a bit odd, but I think the most odd thing about it is that groups of people, wherever they are groups of people, wherever they are. And these are just the same as community activists who are trying to stop a road being built or improve the natural environment near where they live. It's the same process. It's just people working in a different context. Of course, the ripples of impact are bigger, but those ripples of impact are built on the shoulders of those people in the local level, in the regional levels, at the national level, who are making the change on climate that then adds up and really can build the confidence that together as a planet, together as a world, we can really make massive change.
Absolutely. And one of the things I'm going to be quite careful with in this podcast is jargon, because the UN process is absolutely riddled with it. So I thought we should just start with, for the uninitiated, explaining what is COP? And then also if you could talk about why it was a big deal for the UK to be hosting that in 2021.
Sure. So COP stands for Conference of the Parties. Parties are effectively nations. So under the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, which is the UN's primary body that brokers conversations on climate change, you have 197 parties, the COP, that meets those conference of those parties, which are all of the countries in the world coming together and working out what they are going to do collectively and independently to be able to tackle climate change.
And so then the second part of that question, like why did the UK want to host it? Why was that so important to us as a country?
So I don't think any country in the world who takes on the hosting of a COP knows what they're getting themselves into. And I'm sure the UK didn't know what it was getting itself into.
Not a walk in the park.
Absolutely. It's really challenging. But effectively, when you are the president of that process, you are like the conductor in the orchestra. So the UN Climate Talks outcome is a sum of the parts of all the countries coming together and working out what they want to do, just like an orchestra performs a piece of music. But the conductor in that orchestra is really important for motivating the different pieces of the puzzle to sing and to move in the right way. They're also really important coaches in saying, let's do better, let's push that further, let's refine this. And then you've got to get it all moving together to be able to achieve the outcomes you want to achieve. So it's a really important role being the COP president. It allows you to conduct, it allows you to push, it allows you to cajole things forward. But ultimately, it's the countries who make the decisions. It's not like there's some high person who decides what's going to happen and everyone follows. Unfortunately, this is far too complicated. This affects our economies, it affects our societies, it affects our lives. No one can just decide a simple answer, even if you are the sort of boss of the process, even for a year or so.
And so if we come forward in time to last year, and in fact this year, I think both of these COP meetings, COP events, are hosted, or the last one was hosted, this one's going to be hosted by oil producing nations, fossil fuel interests in the global economy. How much of a concern is that from the perspective of people wanting to make progress on climate and phasing out those fossil fuels?
Well, let's not forget that the UK is also an oil and gas country and we hosted a COP successfully. It is true that we focused on an area in particular that we had particular strengths in, which was coal, because we'd already started to move away from coal. So certainly there is a lot more scrutiny under whoever is hosting the COP to say, what is it that you do on climate change and how can you bring others along with you unless you can really show your own stripes and be able to move people forward, especially if you come from the developed world? I think it is a conflict of interest that we are a global economy that is dependent on fossil fuels at the same time as a global economy that is trying to have a discussion about getting off them. Of course it is. And of course that has an impact if you are the COP president. But that is the reality of what we're trying to do. We've all built our prosperity on fossil fuels. And now we have to work together with humility, humbly, to work at how we move away from that. So of course it shapes the politics, of course it colours things, but that reality is the reality that we're all living in. And so absolutely it's possible. Also, the fact of the matter is that a COP is the place where the sum of the parts come together. So you've got all of those interests represented, from the smallest island nation who is standing shoulder to shoulder with the largest economy in the world who's massively powered by fossil fuels. It's really important that that conversation is had. And it's really important that any COP presidency really engages in a transparent way that brings in all of the stakeholders. Otherwise, it's like a house of cards. And it was like this with COP26. We were all sort of on tenterhooks. Is this going to pass or is this going to fall apart? And you know, that is the art of getting that outcome done.
And you mentioned coal there and the UK wanting to make that an objective, a kind of phasing out of coal for COP26. What else was the UK trying to achieve with that event in 2021?
What was really interesting about the COP in Glasgow in 2021 was that it was the first crank of the handle of the Paris Agreement. So little potted history of the Paris Agreement. Into 2009 in Copenhagen, the world tried to come together and come up with a global deal, and it basically had a failed dress rehearsal. People weren't prepared enough, they hadn't learned their lines, they came in and it all kind of fell apart. But it created some good progress in some countries, and some countries really started moving ahead with their climate policy. A few years later, they decided, okay, we did have our failed dress rehearsal, but hey, the world still needs us to deal with climate change. Let's come together and agree that we're going to try again. So what they did this time was in 2012 in Durban, they said, we will try again, but let's spend a few years doing our homework and getting ourselves ready to come up with a global deal. And then it came to 2015 in Paris, where the global deal was agreed, and it has different components to it. So it has these top-down elements, which are the common things that the whole planet's going to do. And then it's got a mechanism where countries make their own choices of how they're going to get there. So the top-down elements are, we're going to get to net zero, we're going to move the finance to get us there, and we're also going to build resilience so that we can deal with the climate impacts that are going to come as well. And we're going to do that in a way that keeps warming well below 2 degrees, aiming for 1.5. So that brings us to the COP in Glasgow, 5 years after, well, 6 years, but because of the pandemic, 5 years for the sake of argument, the first crank of the handle of countries having to come forward with their commitments of what they were going to do more inside the 2020s to be able to reduce their emissions, put forward more money and do more on resilience. So we had to go around the houses talking to every country in the world and saying, what are you going to do more? And we had a lot of things on our side. We had on our side the fact that the cost of renewables and a lot of low carbon technologies had fallen massively. So it was entirely possible for governments to be able to do more because it was cheaper. And they'd said, we can do more. We can do this much on this much money. Oh, no, actually, we can do double that because the cost has fallen. And then what we also wanted to do was think about the different parts of the economy that there was a kind of biggest bang for our buck. So we all know that coal is the highest polluting fossil fuel. And also the UK had a good story to tell. So we went around talking to people saying, what can we do more to move away from coal more quickly and really get those emissions out of the system? We also saw that the real good news story of that kind of 5 year or 6 year period had been the massive acceleration in EVs. And so we really pushed on that as well and said, what more can we do on electric vehicles? We also went on forests. Forests is a topic that many countries prioritize potentially more than fossil fuels because there are many countries, particularly in the developing world, who have economies which are more aligned with renewables, and actually land and forestry is more important. And we also pushed on the NDCs, as I said. So we took these different pieces of the economy and said, how can we push these further to be able to do more? And that was quite different because it wasn't about agreeing a global deal. We had some elements of a global deal we also had to do, which were around some of the finer rules around the Paris Agreement. But it was about, how do we deliver this thing? And how do we get that proof that this agreement works, that on the crank of the handle, you can do more? And there will be a future crank of the handle in the next couple of years, and we'll have to show we're doing more again. But on the first crank, the world rallied and showed that we're making progress.
And so it's not, the phrase that comes to mind is confidence trick, which is probably not the right phrase, but it is about building confidence and showing, okay, we've got this far, what's working, what's achievable and realistic to aim for collectively in the coming years. And then we'll step back and reassess and think, okay, well, what's the next push going forwards, and gradually building momentum and building trust, hopefully, through the years as the Paris Agreement gets implemented.
Absolutely. I always describe COPs as confidence tricks. What you have to do is build momentum and confidence into them and momentum and confidence out of them. And if you bring together all of the countries in the world to make those decisions, you are sending really strong market signals about where the global economy is going. And that has so much power in shaping what might come next.
As you've been talking about, the UK has this power as a COP host in that it's conducting the orchestra, to use your metaphor. So there's a kind of convening power there and an organising power. In normal times when the UK is not hosting a COP, which is most of the time, how influential is it in these global forums? Does it punch above its weight politically? Does it have to struggle to make its voice heard?
So it continues to baffle me how influential the UK is on international climate. It's watched so much from all across the world. So the decisions we make really affect the confidence in other countries about whether the transition is happening. Is it slowing down? Is it speeding up? People really look to the UK because the UK is seen as out ahead. they also look at some of the difficulties we're having because they can see us ahead and struggling with things and thinking, oh, is that going to come to us? So we have a huge amount of responsibility, really, in doing our domestic transition effectively because of the impact it has globally. Because we have that track record, we can then use that at the international level. We also have a broader recognition of our competency in terms of participation in international institutions, rule of law, et cetera, et cetera. And so the combination of these two things mean that UK climate foreign policy, massive potential for us and really something that we can be known as. Now we are effectively a middle power post-Brexit, very different relationship with the EU. It's really something that we can lean into, and I really hope that we'll see more of that into the future.
And so much goes into these processes, as you've just been describing, and yet the story that emerges in the media has to be relatively short and simple. And there was one image that rightly or wrongly came to represent the outcome of COP26, at least in the UK media. And that was the COP president, your colleague, Alok Sharma, fighting back tears in the closing session. How representative was that picture of what was going on in that moment as COP was wrapping up?
Yeah, it's a little frustrating because in the grand scheme of history, a huge amount was achieved from that COP. And interestingly, we had a whole range of outcomes that we wanted to achieve. And the piece that became the little tussle in the end was about language on coal. I did a lot of briefing to the press and stakeholders in the run up to the COP. And I kept on telling them completely honestly, you'll see that this language is being put in there now, but it won't stay in there. We have never seen this kind of language in a UN climate agreement before. It's never been prescriptive. It's always been about the rhythm of what countries then decide to do in their own context, their own decision-making. We've never made specific reference to fossil fuels, to energy in this way, so don't expect it to be in there. And then it was. And in a way, I think it took some of the countries by surprise, which is, I think, why we got the political challenge in the end, because none of us believed it was going to stay in, but everyone was kind of expecting someone else to take it out. So it was sort of there. So we made huge amounts of progress. You then have a moment, and it frustrates me still to this day, because I had this conversation with Alok Sharma where I was like, we need to think about the photo. And he was like, Camilla, we've got too much to do. Shh. And we didn't get the photo right. And it's a bit frustrating because people do remember that image. But nonetheless, the reality of the moment is you haven't slept. You've been working flat out for months and months and months to move this forward. We've made huge amounts of progress. And then people are judging a tiny window of what's going to come and what's happening. And that was the window that was judged. So in the material outcome of what we achieved with Glasgow, absolutely huge. In that small comms moment, a slight stumble and kind of mark on our scorecard, which doesn't quite reflect exactly what maybe we achieved in its fullness.
That's really helpful to understand, because I could hear the like frustration in your voice there. But it's, I think, the interaction between these really complicated processes and then making sense of that for the public is always going to be such a challenging moment. And like you say, it's the photo, and inevitably you can only stage manage that so far, can't you? And people are people. We're human beings. We have real feelings. We have real frustrations, and we don't function well on little sleep.
Absolutely.
So I want to go back to what you were saying about COPs being important because you've got the smallest developing nation somewhere in the Pacific sitting right next to the biggest polluters, the largest economies in the world, nominally as equals, because that's how the UN is set up. But in practice, of course, you get power dynamics everywhere. So I wondered which you would say are the most consequential of those power dynamics in the climate context.
Yeah, good question. So no surprises to anyone. The US and China are an incredibly important anchor. And if you look at the Paris Agreement, you had an agreement in 2014 between the US and China, which created a big anchor weight as part of what the Paris Agreement became. And you see that kind of repeated through the big decisions that are made. And that makes sense. These are the largest economies in the world working out what their futures are going to look like. And so, of course, they have a big part to play. Another really important dynamic is the combination of Europe, some of the more kind of progressive developed countries, on climate, and some of the climate vulnerable countries who are really pushing in the context of accelerated transition and a rules-based system. So I think the US and China would love it if they could just write the global deal and force it on everyone. But thankfully, I would say it doesn't entirely work like that. And then you have this kind of other flank, which tries to kind of really put rigor, transparency, strength behind what it's trying to achieve. Increasingly, in recent years, a number of the middle-income countries have more to say on what they want to achieve from the international climate conversation. But it's been an interesting one, because for a long time, a lot of the middle-income countries say, we're developing countries, we just want maximum flexibility. We want the system to work. We're not trying to destroy it. We want it to work. We want it to work on our terms so that we're flexible. And it's something that's going to be very interesting to see how things shift in the next few years, because we all need the international climate regime to work. And I think it will look very differently when middle-income countries are using it for that outcome specifically, as opposed to wanting to work but with their own flexibility. And I think particularly with Brazil coming up as one of the future COP hosts for COP30, that will be a really interesting dynamic to see how they play that and how they start really building out what a climate regime looks like that works in their interests beyond just flexibility.
Right, so you're kind of painting a picture there of the UN as an institution with a set of rules and processes, not least votes, where everybody, you know, one country, one vote, that has to stand against the really significant economic interests and the geopolitical power of some of the largest countries in the world, and the shifting dynamics around that as different countries develop and grow and their interests align and shift with other countries. So the UN institution is doing a lot of work there, having to hold together this process whilst those economic interests are really kind of fighting out at the same time.
Yeah, although at the same time, you need those economic interests. I mean, I think we had this idea for a long time that climate was something that we could do on the sidelines as a thing we could agree. It's morally the right thing, perhaps, or scientifically the right thing. But really, this is about a huge amount of different interests and organizing them in a fundamentally different way, because we have built our prosperity on fossil fuels. We now have to rewire power and power. So if that's energy power, if that's the power we get from food and water, or if that's political power, because things are going to look very different. And it's very interesting, because I would argue that the country in the world who has most bet on net zero in terms of their political and economic futures, I would argue that that's China. And China is an emerging power. I mean, emerged in many senses already, but it is it is the power of this era and eras to come, whereas arguably the West were sort of the powers of the past and still to different extents to today. And that's a very different set of dynamics, but this isn't something that you can do in a vacuum. This isn't a technical exercise. This is an exercise about our futures, which is about trade-offs. It's about money. It's about power, and it's about national interest. And there is no shame in that. And when people talk about, 1.5, absolutely. But 1.5 is a value choice. It is a value choice that is informed by science, but 1.5 looks different in different places. So 1.5 is the temperature limit that globally countries aspire to limit warming. We may get to 1.6, but perhaps 1.6 is a better choice because you get a certain amount of people protected in a different way. And that's okay. But we're really working on trade-offs now. We're not just plotting things on a graph and making things happen. You've really got to work through those politics if you want something that's really going to stick and be implementable, because this is hard. Changing an economy because you have a digital innovation is difficult. Changing an economy because you're trying to decarbonize it is difficult. And we're trying to do all of these things at the same time.
And so given the significance, as you say, of economic power to finding the solutions and implementing solutions to climate change, how does what happens in COPs compare to what can be achieved through some of the more economically oriented multilateral clubs like the G7, for example, or what can be done bilaterally, one country working directly in partnership with another? Do they all have a place, or are they pulling against each other?
So I absolutely think they have a place. I think one thing that's really important to understand about the UN climate talks is it's a UN climate talk. So that's a space that people talk together and work out what to do. It is not an agency. It doesn't do. It gives you a drumbeat of when you should go away and do. And so whereas G7s, G20s are much more about alignment, they're much more about working together, about achieving different outcomes and shifting those economic and political choices. So you need all of these different pieces to come together and then be the sum of the parts at the UN climate talks. But when you're trying to do implementation, these economic decision-making spaces are going to become more and more important. So the development banks will become more important. The G20 in terms of a space for building alignment to be able to create different global economy that works in a way that is more aligned with net zero and decarbonisation and also climate resilience. We're going to have to cooperate really differently because the future looks so different to the past. So you need all of these different pieces. Climate isn't something that is nice to have over there. It is something that affects every single outcome you want to achieve in the world. If that is more democracy, if that is more prosperity, if that is happier people, all of these things will have climate butting into them because climate is context. It is something that shapes everything we want to try and achieve. And we've got to understand that the best we can so that we can achieve what we want, whatever that we're motivated to do.
And settings like the UN, or indeed the G7, you know, all these big sort of multilateral processes can often appear quite faceless and institutional to the layperson, aside perhaps from the high level segment when heads of government turn up. But in recent years, we've seen the emergence of climate envoys, which are kind of like a new type of diplomat. So when Joe Biden became US president, he made John Kerry his climate envoy. And this was someone who'd previously been a presidential candidate and secretary of state. So he was really a high status appointee. So I wondered if you could reflect on how significant these roles are to outcomes in the real world.
So John Kerry's done a great job, and he's done a great job flying around, being a pest, asking people to do things, challenging people, and having worked inside government is busy. There's always something to do. If someone shows up that you have to have a meeting with, it forces the system to prepare and think about doing something differently. So it's an incredibly important piece of the puzzle. The only thing that I would caution is that in some places we have tried to come up with climate outcomes through environment ministries, but environment ministries are not going to be able to make all the decisions that apply to transport, energy, land, tourism, education, health, which now climate intersects with, because everything is climate and we have to work through all those different levers. So yes, they're really important. They force it onto the agenda. That's what COPs do too. They give you a moment in time where you have to focus on climate, even if you're busy with everything else for quite a lot of the other time. And they can be really constructive. But if they don't sit in the right place, if they're not empowered to talk about trade, if they're not empowered to bring a kind of economic transaction to the table, then they can only go so far in what they're trying to achieve. And I think that's something we're going to have to see quite differently in the coming years. It's not just about going along and saying, look at this chart. This is what shows me that you should be able to achieve against climate science. Therefore, do it. It also reflects equity, whatever. It's more going along and saying, okay, I am the UK. We have specialism in this type of economic sector. We've worked out that you could do X, Y, and Z. We might be able to cooperate and collaborate and achieve this. How does that sound? Therefore, you could do more. That's a much more granular and particular way of talking about things. And that's the way that we're going to have to go if we want to continue to have influence in that diplomatic space.
And on that point about sitting in the right place within government, I mean, you, when you were holding the pen on the COP strategy, you were in the COP unit, which was a special team set up within the Cabinet Office, which presumably was quite significant because the Cabinet Office is like a coordinating department right in the middle of Whitehall. Did you feel like that worked, sitting in that particular department? Like, what were the biggest challenges that you found that you had to grapple with from that position?
So I think it worked pretty well. It worked well because you had other teams to dock into in all the other departments. So it allowed you to pull together all those different strings and make some choices around it. No one department can do this anymore. It is a cross-government competency because it is rewiring the economy of any government. And so being able to pull on those different levers is really important. It's absolutely reflecting on it and talking to colleagues who are continue to be in the UK government now, they miss having that brain that allowed them to work at how their piece of the puzzle added up to something bigger. And I think that that function can be incredibly powerful for projecting internationally, but also really powerful if you did it more internally, domestically. And we did some of that to be able to support the campaign. But I also think that domestic coordination around the different pieces is going to become more important. We kind of have that in a way through the CCC, so the Climate Change Committee, and the reflections that that gives on where different parts of the government need to go. But that's not the same as providing the kind of policy advice, coordination, and also then the dock into the political rhythm of being able to push that forward through ministers, through prime ministers, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that political dimension, because I think, am I right in remembering that there was a new cabinet subcommittee set up as well to look at the climate process?
Yes.
And did that have an impact?
Yeah, that's really important. Again, it's just another thing that forces it on the agenda in a very difficult and busy time. And you do need these clunky, boring governance things, which basically force a bunch of civil servants to do a load of prep, to be able to put on a timeline of when things need to be decided, and then get things out the door. So I think these pieces of governance can be really helpful for moving it along. And, you know, increasingly, so much of government is going to be touched by these topics, and you're going to really need to keep an eye on the different pieces to be able to effectively deliver on the targets. We've spent a lot of time in the outside world, you and I both, alongside many others, trying to create the right narratives, the right advocacy, the right targets, and governments have signed up to lots of them. Now we need to work out what is the craft of government for doing them, and that is really tough. Not impossible. There's lots of things that we can learn from previous things that governments have done, but it's going to require a lot more work, a lot more learning, and a lot more coordination as well.
Yeah. And you've talked there about how the implementation of climate goals requires this coordination across different departments of government within different bits of the economy. I want to look as well at foreign policy more broadly, because climate talks don't happen in a vacuum. Countries might be negotiating on carbon emissions while also being in a trade dispute or even in armed conflict. So I wondered how diplomats manage to make progress on climate when it has to sit alongside so many other foreign policy objectives.
It's tough. I mean, it's funny, I spent a long time saying climate should be at the top table of geopolitics, and now I'm like, oh my goodness, climate is at the top table of geopolitics. There's so many trade-offs here. But at the same time, sometimes the trade-off will be you will get your seat on this whatever in the UN system, and therefore you will do X, Y, and Z. And that's normal. Trade-offs don't just go just on climate lines. They go into all sorts of different kinds of things. But really, if we want to take climate seriously and do it as the grown-up thing that it is a lot about competitiveness. And that's why trade in particular is really coming into these discussions. So we saw that at COP28, a lot of rumbling around, okay, CBAMs. But I have to say, in the run-up to COP26, CBAM was...
Sorry, I've got to cut in here. What's a CBAM?
Good question. Let's see if I can get this right. Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism, which is basically a mechanism which says if you're a country which has invested a huge amount in the transition, you might then prevent or put charges on the same materials, say steel, for example, coming into your economy that are more carbon intensive, because then it's not cost competitive. So people complain about this. They say, oh, no, that's not fair because we're not there yet. And say, well, tough. You know, that's where we're trying to go. Obviously,
so it's
you have
kind
to...
of in the world of carrots and sticks, it's a bit of a stick. It's saying, look, if you're not going to decarbonize your economy at a rate that's reasonable to keep it within safe levels of global warming, then we're going to tax you, essentially.
Yeah, for sure. It can also be a carrot, because it's like, get ahead and be competitive, mm-hmm. and move now. Obviously, you've got to have some flexibilities for some economies that just don't have the access to these technologies, and you've got to be reasonable about it, and you can't be a pain. Like, you've got to engage in a way that is productive and constructive. But in the world of getting stuff done, there are carrots and sticks, and you need both of them. So these conversations around trade are entirely relevant. And you've seen this, as I said before, China's so heavily bet economically and politically on net zero. And that means that they've got a huge amount of the supply chain that we need to be able to transition our economies. We're a bit behind. We haven't invested as much, and now we're going to have to do more. it's unrealistic to think that China's not going to be part of the global transition, but I can guarantee you that whoever's listening to this will be in a room full of things that are made in China. It is part of our economy. That is the way that things happen. But we have to navigate how we do that competitively now, because this is the future. This is modernity. And you see that all the time when you go and talk to middle-income countries now. Before, it was something maybe that the West was doing. Now they see it as the future. They see it as modernity. They see it as the aspirational direction of travel. And so there's all of these different dynamics that you're navigating. It's not just a, oh, we'll do climate because maybe that will get us some kudos on the world stage.
And staying on the topic of having climate at the top table of geopolitics is tough. I mean, we've had some major shocks that have shaken the geopolitical landscape. Recently, we had the COVID pandemic, Russia invaded Ukraine, and there's also now the war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. How have these kinds of dynamics affected how straightforward it is to broker agreement on climate? And how optimistic or pessimistic are you about the ease with which we'll be able to make progress in UN climate talks going forward?
I mean, of course, rightly, they absorb a lot of attention, and that's not the wrong thing. And of course, that has some impact on different political dynamics. But sometimes it has impacts or, you know, cascade impacts that are actually beneficial. So, for example, Russia's invasion of Ukraine has had both constructive and destructive impacts on climate, because it has forced Europe in particular to reconsider its understanding of energy security. And that has led to an increased investment in renewables and increased investment in energy efficiency to move away from a dependence on fossil fuels, which is connected with Russia as a partner. It has also pushed up the cost of fossil fuels, which means that the fossil fuel sector is very politically and economically rich right now. And they are using this sort of final hurrah, let's hope, to invest and to also muddy the waters. And they are investing politically as well as economically in their expansion and their social license, etc., etc. So it's not like any of these things happen in a vacuum. Similarly, from the conflicts that are going on in other places as well, you're seeing effects on prices, and that is also impacting, and effects on food and those broader dynamics. So none of this happens on its own. It's all interconnected. There are upsides and downsides to that, and you have to navigate it. I would say that climate remains a place where cooperation is still possible, even when things are challenging. And you see that most keenly in the context of the US and China relationship, where climate has been the staple that has continued, even if things have got really challenging. So it is an important place for cooperation. Of course, it is affected by other global trends, but we need to harness those global trends if we are to be realistic in actually changing the economy in the way that we needed to change.
And final kind of question, I want to come back to the UK, which is generally the area that this podcast looks at. It's election year. The polls suggest it's very likely there'll be a Labour government by late autumn. So the first time that we'll have a different political party in charge for 15 years or so. So that could be an opportunity to reset the UK's approach to climate diplomacy. Do you think that's necessary? And what would you say are the main priorities for that?
I think it's going to be a big shock for a Labour government if that is what the polls say and that comes to fruition, because they haven't operated in a government like this. When they were operating, it was climate was something that a little part of a department could do and was kind of far off in the future. Now it intersects with pretty much any decision you're making across government. And so working out how to make that function and how to do that governance is really hard. And we don't have loads of models all over the world of how that works. There's some bits of governments that we can borrow from. There are a lot of lessons that we can learn from the Biden administration and what they've done around their IRA, the big package of subsidies and investments around the transition. And we need to learn those lessons. We can also learn from Germany, who has gone really big on climate, and it's had different manifestations across different departments, and working at how we can navigate that. I think you will need that more centralized coordination mechanism. And I'd like to see a kind of new version of the COP unit, but not the COP unit, back in a kind of coordination function. with probably increased capacity, particularly in the Treasury, will be really important, because there's some big choices and big trade-offs to be made, and you need to really upskill the Treasury to be able to harness the private sector opportunities as well as make the choices around the public investments that will be necessary for this. So it's going to be a whole new world, which we're going to have to learn. And some of it, we can borrow some learnings from different countries, and some of it, we're going to have to work it out ourselves, try and test a few things, and just be realistic that it's not going to be plain sailing. We've never lived in an economy like this before. We've never lived in a world like this before. We're going to be dealing with climate impacts. We're going to be dealing with competitiveness challenges about implementing the transition. And we're also going to be dealing with cost of living, energy security. And there's so much alignment with all these different pieces. It still baffles me that we got into a situation where prices went up because of fossil fuel volatility. And on the whole, a lot of investments have been made in fossil fuels to solve the problem, when we know it is fossil fuel volatility that causes us these cost of living crises and problems. So we have lots of choices that we can make to really improve people's lives by investing in the net zero transition. But it's not going to be easy. It's going to be a fun, creative challenge. And I'm excited to keep working with you, Amy, because you're going to be part of that. We need to make it work.
Lots of work to do. Brilliant. Thank you so much, Camilla. It's been fascinating talking with you. I've really learned a lot, actually, because I spend most of my time thinking about the domestic side of things. And I really appreciate you joining Political Heat today.
Thanks, Amy. It's been great.
I hope you found that behind-the-scenes tour of international climate politics as insightful as I did. Often I find there's a kind of mystique attached to the world of diplomacy. So I really liked how Camilla compared those high-level negotiating tables to any group of people trying to figure out a path forward together, like a group of local nature activists. It was also interesting to talk about how climate diplomacy is changing. The need for much more involvement from ministries of finance and trade, for example, reflecting the way net zero is an economic phenomenon, not just an environmental one. And I thought Camilla summed it up well with that neat phrase, climate is context. And finally, it was good to understand how international diplomacy can make a difference. Global agreements and partnerships between smaller groups of countries can send powerful signals to markets about the direction of travel. But those international processes have to be nested with layers of national and local activity and momentum. In the next episode of Political Heat, I'm going to take a closer look at something that's been a hugely important source of the UK's national momentum and international leadership, the Climate Change Act. I'll be talking with Baroness Bryony Worthington, who not only led the campaign for the Act, she then worked inside government to draft the bill that was introduced to Parliament. If you're enjoying this podcast, please add a rating or a review and subscribe. I'd also love to hear any feedback, and you can send an email to politicalheatpod@gmail.com or find me on Twitter at politicalheat24. I'm also writing newsletters to accompany each episode of Political Heat, which you can find on Substack under the same name. Political Heat was produced and presented by me, Amy Mount. It was edited by Sarah Eldridge. Thanks for listening.